Find the answers to questions you may or may not have asked yourself here at Collider Science, Conversations on Cognitive Science, hosted by Elisa Palmer and Sönke Löw. Before we start with today's episode, I want to give a short disclaimer. Today's episode contains discussions about explicit content, including, but not limited to, pornography, image-based sexualized violence, and the use of deepfakes. We understand that these topics can be sensitive and may evoke strong emotions. If any of these subjects is distressing for you, please consider skipping this episode. Our aim is to approach these topics responsibly and from a scientific background, but we also understand their sensitivity. If you are impacted and need support, please consider reaching out to a helpline or professionals in your area. In the show notes, you can find some resources, but there might be better suited ones wherever you're coming from. Now, let's proceed with today's episode.
To begin this episode, I want to tell a short anecdote, maybe. Yesterday, I was looking through the Google images of a famous actress. And one on the first page of the Google images, it already says, like, naked photos of, and the URL had something about AI generated something in it. Mm-hmm. And that immediately raised my attention, because that's exactly the topic of today's episode. And for that, we like to welcome Annemarie Witschers, who is an expert in this field. Welcome.
Well, thank you so much for the introduction. And yeah, happy to be here.
I think this topic is going to be really interesting and exciting for also for us to record and talk about. But before we go into the topic deeper, we, as always, want to play our short get-to-know game. I give you five sentences or five sentence beginnings and ask you to finish those. Mm-hmm. The first sentence is, as a kid, I always wanted to be.
So there were always a bunch of things. I think first I wanted to be a cat. So I was really hoping one day I would turn into a cat. And then it really varied from interior designer to diver, you know, like exploring mm-hmm. the underwater coral reefs. Maybe also a writer or psychologist at some point. So I think this is also why I'm at cognitive science, because I could not just decide for one thing when there's so many cool things to explore.
I'm just still thinking about the cat. Why did you want to be a cat?
I mean, they just have great lives. They can sleep a lot, get food, and are just very fluffy.
True. Yeah, I see that.
I think life would be easier as a cat sometimes.
Yeah, definitely. If I was an emoji, I would be?
I would be the side-eye emoji, you know, the ones that like eyes, but they look too... It's just eyes, doesn't have a face. Yeah.
Why?
I think I just like the kind of sentiment that it transports. It's just this being a bit like cheeky, looking to the side.
Yeah.
Yeah. That or just the dolphin with the water coming out.
Yeah. Nice. My favorite thing to do on a day off is?
Making good food. A lot of nice food and going on a walk. Probably I'll be at the beach this week because I'm going to Barcelona tomorrow.
Nice. On holiday or?
In a way.
Nice. I guess there's going to be much better weather than here in Norway.
Yeah. I'll try to bring the spring back to Osnabrück when I return.
Well, that would be good. Right now, I'm most fascinated by...
I think I'm most fascinated about time recently. So about like the notion of how time, or there's different conceptions of time, and that can vary a lot depending on which Zeitgeber you have. So like kind of which external circumstances you have that give you an orientation whether you should be faster or you should be slower, and how much that changes to like perception of our lives. I don't know if you've noticed, but since there is a semester break, time flows very differently than during the semester.
Honestly, not for me this term, because I'm doing more lectures in my lecture-free period this semester. Mm-hmm. But
well, then maybe it's the other way around.
Yeah, I think so. I know it's time to call it a day when.
Yeah, like I would not know. I'm also a very night owl, so I don't really have a very stable rhythm of when to do things and when to stop doing things. So I sometimes have these like nightly things of, yeah, I stay up a long time for a long time. And I think people who've done courses with me will know that I will send out emails at a time when you're not sure whether I'm still awake or I'm already awake.
But, which case is it usually?
still awake one. But yeah, no, I think it's a process of having a more rhythm. So I'll tell you about that next time, how it's going.
So having gotten to know you as a person a bit better, mm-hmm. I would now love to hear where you started your whole scientific or cognitive science journey, where you're at now, and also what were your main fields of interest during your time at studying it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I did my bachelor's here in Osnabrück, and I started, am I going to say that? Yeah, no, I started in 2017 here, and I did actually a different study program before, which was not working so well for me, or it was not interesting me. And I just like the possibility the option of having many different fields that are really interesting me that I can study here. And actually, I was very scared in the beginning when I applied about all these complicated sounding fields of neuroinformatics or artificial intelligence or computer science. And I was counting, okay, I have to do 5. So maybe I can just not do those because they sound really complicated and really scary. And I don't have any prior knowledge to that. And then interestingly, once I started, those were the first modules that I filled and the first, the things that really interested me. And I guess the fields that I was more interested in when I applied, like linguistics, was something that I'm dropped quickly. So yeah, that was also kind of like this a bit of an empowering process to figure out that things can be very scary, and there's also like this gender dimension of whether you can see yourself doing a certain thing or not. And I think it's very, very nice that the study program here also gives that opportunity and offers people neuroinformatics might be a big and scary word, to try that out.
Yeah. So you've done your bachelor's and now are you doing your master's?
Yeah.
Are you a bit further already? So
yeah, now I'm in my master's and now I'm mostly focusing on AI or machine learning and philosophy. But mm-hmm. yeah, mostly I'm also working in the ethics and critical theories of artificial intelligence working group here or research group. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's my focus right now.
And today we are going to talk about your bachelor's thesis or the topic you focused on during your bachelor's thesis, which is already combining AI and philosophy ethics. So can you maybe tell us a bit about what you did, what you tried, or what you wrote about, and how you came to that topic?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So the idea was to make, to look at AI from a societal angle and to look at how AI also manages to bundle and exercise power. And I think there's all different kinds of way of approaching that idea of power. And there has been a lot of talk about bias also. And I think that's very relevant and it's very important. And a lot of people have been talking about that. And I wanted to shift the gaze more to the topic of social normativity and how AI can create something that it just seems so normal, or that is something that societies do in general. But I was interested in how AI changes that, maybe accelerates that, or just enforces those things. And I think I came to the, well, I chose the topic of pornography as a lens through which to like investigate how AI has influences or has impact on societies and on our digital selves and like the world that we live in and the experience we can make. And I guess that is the starting point, which is this kind of conflicting or weird observation back in the time. So I it's already been a while. So I wrote it in 2020 or handed it in 2021. And so back then, I was observing how on user-generated platforms, so that means just basically social media platforms where users upload content, there was this very strict moderation guideline in terms of what you can post and what you cannot post. And there was this big debate about whether you can show female presenting nipples or not, whether, I don't know, there can be photos of breastfeeding, whether there can be any photos of like nudity. And also that was different for different genders. This observation of there are strong forces at play that try to keep any instance of human sexuality from the social media platforms, even though we would think that social media and everybody's exchanging and freely, they are supposed to portray our lives as they are. And then just very interesting how this part is cut out and is made invisible. And on the other hand, we have porn sites like tube sites, and it's just fascinating, like how much traffic goes to those tube sites platforms, and it's like three of the most 20, like the 20 most visited websites daily are porn sites, and those are the ones that have very questionable labor conditions, very questionable forms of content, like either that is content that which was uploaded unconsensually, debates about minors and like forced content, but also a lot of content that has been copyright, has been stolen and copyright infringed. So, and just, I think it was just interesting to see how, well, this whole phenomenon of tube site porn platforms, which make up this huge amount of the internet, how that is not really talked about a lot in academic discussions. And also, my hypothesis or speculation was that there's also a form of, sex negativity at play there that shapes whether we can talk about this in academic discourses, and that might be also similar reasons why we treat sexuality on content on platforms and social media platforms that way. And and then the idea was to see what AI has to do with that, and it turns out it's quite interwoven in both of those fields, in the field of content moderation and also in the field of tube site porn platforms. And this is what I looked at.
So you've just talked a bit about in how far different platforms show or don't show nudity and, bodies of both sexes and genders, but especially restrict the representation of female bodies or female seen bodies. And I was wondering in how far was the term pornography equivalent to nudity, or is there a difference? Where's the difference, especially from the lens you viewed it?
Mm-hmm. I think I'm not sure if I really had like a proper definition of pornography, even if there even is such a thing. I was more investigating like how platforms see that concept, and for them, so we're talking about large-scale platforms, and they're using a mixture of automated and human moderation. So it's like this socio-technical system that both combines human workers and algorithms that do like a pre-selection, and then the unclear cases get handed over to moderators who work mostly in the global south, where labor conditions are not great and the wages are low. And given that it's such a big apparatus and there's so much content, it's not that there is a very like fine-grained understanding of whether a content is pornographic, like whether what does that even mean? and a lot of the like more technical algorithms that I looked at, they're just a skin detection algorithm, looking at nudity. And yeah, seeing that as a proxy for porn, which of course has its flaws. There can be, yeah, false positives, false negatives. I mean, there can be beach photos with a lot of skin that are not porn. And there can be like, I don't know, forms of latex porn or something where people are not showing a lot of skin. And that would still classify. So, yeah, I think there's not really a clear definition. And I was keeping the concept vague. But I think it's just interesting to remark when platforms talk about pornography, just seeing a naked person, like a photo of a naked person, especially like female person, that just gets classified as porn or as like nudity, and it's very the blurry, the gradient between the two.
Yeah. Talking about like the different interpretations of what nudity and pornography is and if it should be allowed or not, I was thinking that like the most social media platforms are like in the hands of American companies, and then they have like their ideology maybe, because like there's also this stereotype where in movies or other types of content, like they display Germans as like people who are very free with nudity and like very open to showing their body, and in this case like on social media that's not allowed, and they're all or mostly like American companies. Have you also looked like at this political aspect of like how content moderation is used, or did you more look like at the technical aspects maybe?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. It's super intricate at that aspect. And I was actually in one part looking particularly at Tumblr, which maybe some of the older listeners still remember as a different place. And so what was interesting in that example is that it had this shift in content moderation policy where, like, basically from one day to the other next, or like in a short period of time, they were erasing a lot of pornographic content or any form of like nudity or sexuality expression. And there are rumors, or it's like mildly confirmed that it had to do with the content moderation policies of Apple. So the bottleneck is that things go to the App Store in Apple, and that Steve Jobs was like notoriously known for being anti-sex. And he allegedly, no, I think he said that in an interview, that folks who want porn should buy an Android phone. And that is just really fascinating how not just like this company, but even like a very influential person inside that company has a lot of impact on basically all people who use Apple products and what kind of apps they can use on their devices. And it's not like Android or other forms of operating systems where you can just also install applications from other sources, but on Apple you just have the Apple Store, and that's going to be kind of the door through which you can access the digital world. And if the person kind of controlling that bottleneck says we don't like porn and we don't like sexual expression, that has a huge impact. So this will be one way, like the whole platform administration way, where it's not only the like platforms such as like Facebook or Tumblr, but also the other kind of platforms that dock into the, this bigger ensemble of companies, and also forms of where are the data sets coming from, and who are the commissioners of the content moderation labor units, what kind of management guidelines do they give out. And there's another example from TikTok where leaked documents revealed that it had explicitly stated in its content moderation guidelines to suppress the visibility of disabled and queer users, allegedly because they wanted to protect these kinds of people from like unwanted attention. But it's just like, a repressive force. Mm. And the form of who has that power to decide over how we can, relate to each other and what we can show. Yeah, it's super interesting. And the whole, I think there's also this global aspect, not sure how clear that got already, but it is, as you said, very much like bigger corporations in the global north that then commission workers in the global south to do this like very horrific job of moderating content and all the violent trash that people upload, and that the workers there who do content moderation just make the sites usable and enjoyable for everyone else.
That was such a rich answer. I still have to process some of your parts, but one thing I was wondering about, you now explain a bit how far one single person from a company can influence and how far content is shown in different social media. Is there also anything known about how this shown content influences how people feel or talk about the content they see?
You mean users?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm not sure if that's what you're aiming up with your question, but in the context of content moderation and also deepfakes, which was the second topic example that I studied. It was interesting for me to see how the repressive effects of gendered violence online has an effect on how people behave, how especially like women internalize the patriarchal logics, and they adapt to that by either adapting their online profiles and displaying a good girl image online, but that can also lead them to change how they behave in an offline setting. And I think that was most interesting when I looked at deepfake porn.
Can I maybe explain what deepfake is in general? Yeah. For the term.
So deepfake is a technology, maybe some people also know it as face swap. And so the idea is that you can insert the facial features of a person onto another video. So if I have enough, training data, so that means if I have enough photos or short videos of Elisa or of Sönke, then I would be able to learn your facial features and project them onto an existing video. And that there's a lot of, entertaining instances of that on YouTube where, they make Barack Obama, I think, say something funny, or you have that with a lot of actors. And it's a big debate mostly for the whole misinformation discourse, and people are, I think rightfully so, scared on the impact it will have on democracies and the epistemic threats that poses as to whether video material is still convincing or it's just everything can be faked nowadays. And it's also an interesting observation how there was this big discourse about the threat to democracy that faces, but the actual way in which deepfakes were used in that time was like 96% for pornography, for unconsensual pornography. And so it's also interesting how that whole part of the discourse got then blended out. And in deepfake pornography, what happens is that, you just take a person's facial features and project them onto a pornographic video or also photos sometimes. And a lot of this happens without the consent of the person whose facial features are taken. there are some instances where people consent to this, and it's then like, you know, like professional, like, sex workers, artists, that they would say, okay, I sell my facial features and then you can do something with it. But in most of the cases, the large majority, it's people either from real life, like that from day-to-day lives, but also a lot of public figures who are then, whose facial features are taken and put onto porn. And then there's entire porn sites that focus on, deepfake porn, where you can look at your, favorite actress doing things, or a lot of very weird, very confusing stuff. Also in the whole section of, private people, people that are not really public faces. And as part of that investigation, I looked at what kind of effects that has on the people affected by it. And it just, from what I've read, it's really a hard thing to process. People struggle a lot just because it's this form of violence that happens to you. And it's not only of seeing that image and like seeing that your face, which is something, you know, very, well, personal, very intimate, and kind of the thing that makes you you in a way, is taken and abused in that context. There's a lot of second order consequences for people, such as that they're... there is defamation in the sense that like they can use their jobs or their career, their credibility, and just struggle with mental illnesses. And also these things operate a bit as a like repressive force, and then also create this climate of misogyny that is then again internalized by other people. And there was this prominent example which I think was one of the earlier form of deepfake pornography from an Indian investigative journalist. And so she sometime before she did this investigation about the Indian government and revealed that they had been implicit in some murders and riots that were happening in the country. And just, because she's a woman and because she's Muslim, she already faced a lot of, like, misogyny and anti-Muslim hate online. And at some point, this deepfake video of her was published and just completely ruined her. And she was documenting online how she went from a very outspoken person to someone who got really scared and changed the way that she spoke and... that she spoke online also as a person in an offline setting. And for me, that's where it gets interesting and where we can see how power operates and how power has a bit this like strategic function. And I build a bit on that concept of Antonio Gramsci of cultural hegemony, which basically says that something is really powerful if it manages to be pre-reflectively accepted by a lot of people. So if it's just this thing that is normal to you and you wouldn't even question, then that is like the actual power. And then I looked at how AI in that setting, either through the context of you're able to generate deepfake images at large scale, and distribute them, and also the kind of the underlying notions that are moderated through content moderation on social media platforms, how they establish in their cultural hegemony how they will reproduce norms that are more heteronormative, more like this patriarchal binary sex able-bodied logic that also goes in a hand with kind of reinforcing a certain status quo.
Yeah, I think it's like particularly interesting like the difference between all versions of like this deep fake porn are like pretty horrific, but like if you maybe not think about like the other person's perspective and you just, I don't know, like generate something or watch something of a famous person, maybe you don't even know that it's like deepfake, then it's like one aspect, but as soon as like it has malicious intent, like destroying the career of a journalist or like even on a more personal level, I mean, you wrote in your bachelor thesis about like this phenomenon of revenge porn, like that's a whole another level of how terrible this situation is. And maybe at this point you could also like explain maybe what revenge porn is, because like I just introduced this keyword and maybe someone doesn't know what it is.
Yeah, oh, I hope so. I wish for most people to not know about it. No, and actually the term revenge porn is not really preferred, because it implies that the term revenge implies that there was something bad the other person did. And that's why they deserve
blaming again.
Yeah, they deserve to be revenged. Mm-hmm. And so I think experts rather speak of image-based sexualized violence, and that's kind of what it is. So it's someone doing a form of violence to you through your, images. And taking your facial likeness and replicating that. And or I think the common example is just that nudes or any like explicit images and videos are shared by an ex-partner to other people.
I think this whole topic of deepfakes in pornography is so terrifying that I just realized the whole time I'm thinking about, is there any way we can recognize if a video is a deepfake or not? Because I know that deepfakes or pictures can be really hard to determine whether it's a real person, a deepfake picture. Mm-hmm. Is there any kind of, I don't know, technology or tool to kind of be able to determine whether a video is a deepfake or a real video?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's gradients. And the quality varies a lot for deepfake porn. And there are some that just look bad. You have something like a mask on, and when the person turns to the side, it just like kind of falls off. And you you notice that just does not look real. Or sometimes when there's a hand covering part of the face and it just like doesn't render, then it's very easy to spot. But of course, there's also instances that are more professionally done, and the rendering is very good, and you would not notice any like spots where it breaks. And then there's the whole discussion about, we have these great algorithms. So most of the deepfakes are done with GANs, like generative adversarial networks. So we have these great like deep neural networks to produce these videos. Now we just need other GANs and other deep neural networks so we can spot them and tell them apart, because this is kind of what they can do very well, those models. I think to a certain part that is probably justified, and there is some sense in saying, okay, we want to be able to spot them and we want to be able to like take them offline, just because, that is a form of like violence and people suffer from this, and they don't consent to this. But a part of me also is just, it's this weird cat and mouse race where you're just making your algorithm better, and then you have to figure out, like, you make this other algorithm to spot it. And the way, the way that generative adversarial networks work is through this adversary, so through this other model. And so it just seems like, why would you put a lot of effort into creating this adversarial part to detect deepfakes when you can then incorporate that kind of model to improve your deepfake even better, to force your generator to make even better images that are not spotted by the discriminator. So these are the two aspects of the GAN.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating. And I'm thinking, like, we talked about, like, that content moderation is like a mixture maybe of real humans and like these AI networks, but especially for like the discrimination between deepfake or a normal video, it's like if it's professionally done, it's like very hard even for humans, I think. But in general, like the content moderation aspect of it, because you said like on the social media platforms there are like the workers that then don't have great working conditions and are really exploited. Is that maybe like for simpler solutions or like for simpler questions, if not the question if it's a deepfake or not, is that like a big advantage of having AI models do it, because then you don't need those workers? I'm not sure if that's like better for them if they don't have a job, or like if that industry isn't there, or if like the horrible working conditions are better, but that's like a whole nother question. Mm-hmm. Like, is it just an advantage then to use models for content moderation, or are there also drawbacks?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a very good question. And I have been quite conflicted about the answer, because I see how on the one side, when you use an AI model to moderate content, it's very centralized in a way that you have one model or a type of model, you know, that can scale very well, and you can use it on like all over the world on a global platform, every couple of seconds or milliseconds when something is being uploaded. And that is very scary in the sense you have this authority making decisions for everyone else. And of course, it's lacking a lot of cultural context, which maybe humans are better to do. But then when you look at the working conditions, or when you look at the lives that people working as content moderators have, it's really tough. And I don't want to say like that should not exist as a job or so. And I'm very happy to know that there are continued efforts of content moderators to form a union over the last year, and who are also fighting for, well, better working conditions and fighting for a way. But I also don't think that we should just get rid of the humans and just focus on the AI model and that AI will be the savior. I think that is a big misconception. And they will always, like the AI models will also inevitably need a form of human continuous training. I think that is something that the AI discourse tries to bring forward, saying that there, in the future, we will just have the models and nothing else and no more humans. Whereas it's actually way more likely that the amount of people working in data production and data labeling and content moderation will rise in the future. And in terms of solution, I think it's just very complicated and it requires a lot of, a complicated solution approach on various levels, and I think a lot of questioning of just what kind of content we want to see and what kind of priorities we give, also who matters in the context of technologies when we produce them, what is being celebrated, and who is forgotten in those contexts.
And then on the side, not just like of the content moderators, but also on the side of the users, there's also like this aspect of maybe nuance that is missing in the AI model. So that doesn't, like it treats everything the same. You said like before, like maybe there's skin detection, but then there are maybe images where there is more skin, or where like, especially like nudity in a non pornographic content is like very, very powerful image to like to a bigger picture, and then it's like probably completely missing that in an AI model moderation of this social media content.
I think it's there's probably ways of making the context richer, and this is something that people in AI and machine learning are working on, to not have just like this rule-based naive AI that will be like, oh, we detected such and such many pixels of skin color, and that's why you must be porn. So I think there's different ways of getting context into AI and into image analysis, and that has certainly also advanced like over the last couple of years. But yeah, I think the bigger question of like, well, where does that happen, and who makes those decisions, and who is also excluded from the process, and how are we all affected by it as people who use the internet on a daily basis? How far does that shape what we see as normal content?
I was also just wondering, is there anything the users can do to influence decisions that are made besides posting or besides trying to trick the algorithms? But like, how can each of us have an impact or influence how those platforms work and maybe protect ourselves, but also enable everyone to have the same rights and representation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a difficult answer. I'm not sure if I have like immediate responses to that. I think for me, I like as a starting point to think about understanding more about how these systems work, and understanding, well, who is behind them, and also finding out more about which are the people that become disregarded, like how are marginalized people treated. And other than that, I think you have to also go beyond your role as a user. So I think if you just see yourself as this user and consumer, I think your options for change, for transformation, will always be limited to the kind of leeway that you get from the platform commissioners. And I would say you probably need to step out of that role from time to time.
We talked a lot about power today, and I was also wondering if you know anything about like the structures that it reinforces, because you said like the person that you had as an example who's very powerful was Steve Jobs, which is like a white male, and the person you had as an example of someone who was like greatly hurt by this type of pornography as was like a female Muslim, and I think that's not really a coincidence, I guess. Is it just that it reinforces like the existing power structure, and or is this maybe more complex?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I would say so, but also I have to say that I was looking at very two specific examples, and I'm not trying to make like a generalized claim about pornography and AI overall, but I can say from those two examples that seemed to be very much the case. The people who were hurt and who were suffering were a lot of women and trans people, sex workers, and forms of queer people who were looking for sexual expression outside of that very heteronormative mainstream media. And in terms of who are people who are profiting from the way that the power dynamics are arranged at the moment, it's of course like harder to say who are those people that are creating deepfake porn. Well, I don't know. They do not log in with their ID, so you can. They will probably not fill out demographic surveys. It's a speculation that a lot of them will be straight men. But there is no reliable data on that yet. Let me know if you have any sources to study that.
I think it's also really difficult to start a study on it, because how would you just ask? You could just randomly ask people, be like, are you a producer or are you a producer of deepfakes? And if so, are you white? Are you male? How old are you?
Yeah. Now, actually, I think there were people, like there was a paper they looked into deepfake communities. So that means there is this whole, well, forums, and then they exchange about how to make the deepfake better and how to train models, how to set certain parameters. And the researchers there analyzed how they had a big overlap with Reddit communities and also with open source communities. So just think it's, certain digital spaces that attract a lot of like men, maybe also in a certain age range, probably also with a certain like financial background or a certain socioeconomical position. And I think from those insights, we can see some references and we can see a correlation there in terms of demographics. But also to what you asked, Sönke, I think I would like to point out that I don't want to like stress that it's this very, kind of like hierarchical thing in the sense of, okay, Steve Jobs has all the power to decide over everyone else. But rather that I was following this power conception where power is, you know, distributed and relational. And it's something that everybody is also implicit in to some way or another. So that kind of the agency is distributed. And not to reinforce this understanding of power as in, one person has it and everybody else is subjected to it, but more like it's something that always exists and pre-shapes our social interactions. And it will crystallize around certain points. And then, I think like the platform administration will be one point where there's a lot of crystallization happening, then like the communities developing in that and really, discussing about how they can improve their deepfake image quality while really, objectifying the people they are using their facial features of. So that would be another crystallization point, and then like people who are using it, consuming that.
We now talked mostly about platforms such as Instagram, but also porn websites. But I think most people are using at least one type of messenger, so WhatsApp, Signal, Telegram. I don't know if there are any other big ones at the moment. Am I missing any?
I don't think so. Maybe WeChat? Threema or something.
Threema. But yeah, I think in other countries like WeChat.
Oh, okay. I don't even know that one. Wow.
I think it's like Chinese.
Ah, true. Yeah. Okay, that rings a bell. But talking about messengers, they are starting to evolve communities on messengers. You can add people you don't even know to a chat function and whatever. So is nudity, pornography also a topic in those types of day-to-day use applications, or are we protected in a way there?
Mm-hmm. That's actually a big topic and a big issue. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with, or also if the listeners are familiar with, the whole discourse that was on the chat control by the EU.
Can you briefly just say some words on it?
Yeah. So the idea was that the EU drafts a law that would basically make authorities be able to scan all chats or like private chats of people for the purpose of avoiding child pornography. And well, this is also an issue that I encountered a lot of times, that people will always argue with child pornography because it's just this universally extremely bad thing that everybody will agree on, that is something bad and we want to avoid that. But it turns out that many times there is legislation happening under the name of child pornography, but that then has extreme drawbacks on, for instance, privacy infringements or just increasing surveillance and we can analyze how this whole debate of chat control by the EU was also really criticized by a lot of data protection experts under that aspect. And since you mentioned Telegram, so one part of my investigation, I also found that there are specific channels or bots that make this form of deepfake production very very easy, very accessible. And so you don't even need to train your own models. You will just be able to send a photo of a person and you will get back a nude photo of that person, and the bot will compute for a couple of minutes. And that has also been used in quite scary ways, from either blackmailing the person or just using that to send around the nude photos of that person to other people and set pressure on the person you have been addressing. And if I remember correctly, it was also only possible for female presenting bodies, and otherwise it would just not work.
So when you would send in a male face, would it put it on a female body or just don't react at all?
I haven't tried. Okay. but yeah, it's a good question. And probably it would make a very queer non-binary body. We wouldn't know.
I mean, at least from representation parts, that would be something. I don't want to say good, but it's just really a tough topic to think about. And I honestly don't want to be a person in the situation of having that done to myself. Mm-hmm. Are there any ways people can help themselves, can reach out for help if they realize, okay, there's a deepfake porn nudity picture of me somewhere on the internet? What should people do? Is there any kind of guideline on how to react?
So that's of course a very, really important question to ask and to consider. In Germany, there is one organization that is called Anna Nackt, which was also founded by one person affected by image-based sexualized violence online. And you can find them on their website and reach out to them. Depending on where you are in the world, there might also be other initiatives dealing with that. Other forms of feminist collectives that support with digital forms of violence or also hate speech. And maybe we can link some in the show notes.
We're definitely going to link the Anna Nackt, but also, I guess, one or two international ones to make it accessible for all of our listeners who are affected by it or just want to learn more about it. I guess it's also good for information or purpose.
Yeah.
And then we come to the end of this interview. And as usual, we want to ask you the context of cognitive science. So what fields played really into it, and maybe we can be advanced by research in this field.
Mm-hmm. The way that relates to the field of cognitive science. So I think primarily it draws this connection between artificial intelligence and philosophy, and more precisely this critical feminist perspective on AI. And from that perspective, we can also see how, we can see a different image of AI, and it's not only this kind of narrative that we often hear from, AI is just a tool and you can use it for good things, you can use it for bad things. But when you look at it through this perspective, which is this kind of marginalized perspective of queer and feminist writers and theorists, then you can see how it's really more than a tool. It's something that is a forming a culture and is forming like certain hubs, and that shapes how the technology is being developed and bringing in a lot of like biases, of course, but also like the kind of, yeah, the kind of norm understanding of what is normal flowing into that. And as a part of that, we can see how, yeah, there is always something happening with who are the people who are developing it, who are people who are profiting from a certain development, but also, and most prominently, like, who is being left out, who's disregarded, and who does not appear. And then, yeah, seeing how AI reproduces that and manifests all these dynamics between those different groups of people, seeing that it's more than just a tool that you can use to, well, I don't know, fix a hole in your wall, but how it really brings a culture to life and shapes how people see themselves and understand themselves and can express themselves.
I feel like that's already been quite a good summary of this whole episode as well. I wanted to ask about a summary, but... Or is there anything you would like to add, what people should remember after listening to this episode?
Yeah, maybe my other point for the relation to cognitive science would be that I think it's also an approach to make cognitive science more political, let's say to politicize it. And that's something where already here I see many students involved in that, and I see a lot of people who care about the political dimensions of their work and who care, for instance, about the climate crisis. And I really hope to see that translating more into the field of research as well, so that young people nowadays who are aware of there's something like, I don't know, fossil fuel emission that is destroying the climate, there is, annihilation of species, and there is this right-wing populism happening that we all are living with. This is the world that we are sharing. So really to take a moment, take a step and look around, and then trying to figure out what will we do with it? What kind of research does it need? And maybe also what does it need besides research? Yeah. And yeah, bring in those questions into cognitive science.
So with that being said, I would like to thank you a lot for talking to us, to bring this topic into our podcast and, well, sharing this whole perspective on pornography, deepfakes, and everything connected to it. And I think at least I have to process our conversation quite a lot. And yeah, so thank you very much for being here.
Okay, yeah, thank you so much for the invitation. It was really nice talking to you.
When you enjoy listening to us, the best way to support us is by following us on your chosen podcast app. This could either be Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, or the website of the Cognitive Science Student Journal. Another good way to support us is by following our Instagram account, which is called kaleidoscience_pod. On our Instagram account, you will also get regular information on the next episode. Thanks a lot for supporting us. This was Kaleido Science, hosted by Elisa Palmer and Sönke Löw, produced by Alina Ohnesorge, Elisa Palmer, Sönke Löw and Sophie Kühne, produced in collaboration with the Cognitive Science Student Journal. The music was produced by Jan-Lukas Schröder. The logo was designed by Annika Richter. Thank you for listening and joining us on our journey through conversations on cognitive science.